Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and Dr. John Earhart for Courage to Be Me, a discussion on the experiences of a gay professional. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
So welcome, everyone, and welcome, John. Last time we talked about the Montessori program. And for those of you who missed that, John Earhart is a psychiatrist, colleague, and friend of mine around Rochester, New York. And we're talking about his experience of being gay, coming out as gay, personally and professionally, and what that has been like for him and what it's like for him now. Thank you for being willing to talk about something so important and so personal. I really appreciate that.
Sure. I think if it helps others in that, it's been a long journey.
How about if we start the journey talking about early on, were you aware of being gay or any issues like that when you were a child?
From what I've read, some people feel something early on, you know, like kindergarten, first grade-ish. And I have to admit, back then, something just felt off. But again, at that age, you don't have anything to compare it to. It's just a sense of, I don't know, being different or something. It's hard to say in that. And I'll jump ahead a little bit. In middle school, I went to McQuaid, the eighth grade at McQuaid.
And for those of you who are not from Rochester, that's a private Catholic school, all male at the time, right?
At that time it was, yeah. And there, you know, we're going back over 50 years, but what I remember was there was a PhD student from the university who was working on some project, probably her dissertation, and she wanted to come to an all-boys school and interview boys going into puberty and that, and kind of ask them questions about themselves and that. And I can remember that my answers to her didn't fit her rubric by the expression on her face. Mm-hmm. Because she was asking things, again, 50 years ago, but she was asking, like, you know, how do you see yourself as a boy, et cetera? And then could you see yourself as a girl, et cetera, and that. And I think the expectation was that I was going to say kind of like, no, no, no. Well, I kind of said, oh, yeah, I could. You know, what characteristics do you see that a girl has that you? I said, well, I think girls probably are kinder and more sensitive. Well, I could tell by the facial expressions. It was like I was throwing off her research. And that's, so I remember that. So that was probably the next milestone where I think maybe I'm a little off compared to everybody else in that. And certainly, I think as you go into puberty, you start to sense things. You know what looks interesting, what looks attractive, and that. So that was around that time as well.
Right.
And one of the things, probably starting around that time, probably well into my 20s, into my 30s, probably, was the sense of, oh my God, I find that stuff interesting to look at, to see. It's arousing. And being raised very Catholic, the whole family on both sides, everybody's Catholic, very Catholic, you know, priests in the family, and maybe a, you know, missionary in the family. And my mother went to mass every day. So you have that so then it was like, oh crap, I've got to keep this inside. And so probably starting around middle schoolish, there was this deep, dark secret. Didn't fully understand it. I mean, I had two girlfriends in high school, you know, dated and all that. But again, it's I think that whole development of sexuality there, it's you're still kind of forming it. But there was kind of the social aspect of dating, the relationship stuff. I mean, girlfriend I had in senior year was a lot of fun. You know, we got along great. It wasn't really a friendship. It was a quasi dating friendship kind of thing in that. So you kind of plot along. So I think what happens, you start to get into this thing of, there's this thing, I don't fully understand it. I better keep it hidden away. God forbid anybody find out about it. Because if they do, I'll be teased and mocked in school. I might get beat up. My family will blow a gasket, maybe reject me. And my church has already said that I'm damned. So it's like, crap. And every single front, I'm screwed. So I better just kind of keep this to myself and pray it goes away.
So were you accepting of yourself?
No. At that point, no.
Something seemed to be different. And you were scared, thought something was wrong, knew you couldn't talk to people about it, and you hoped it would go away.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think that, you know, maybe it was a phase, I mean, whatever, and just kind of go through life in that. And I think a theme has been, when anxious, in doubt, when stressed, when there's lots of conflict, I work.
Okay.
You know, and then I think some people would drink, do drugs, do escapism, whatever. I work, you know what I mean? And then, and so I went to college, worked hard. I basically, for my undergraduate, I pretty much paid my way through. So I was going to college and working and this kind of stuff and that. And the first 2 years of college didn't really date. It dated, but you're just like a one-time date kind of stuff, but nothing that was ongoing in that. But I think I got into college and it was clear that what did I find arousing and attractive? It was like, okay, the handwriting's on the wall kind of stuff like that. But I think just kept it all inside, you know.
Right.
Even with close friends, you know, even with my best friend, would not talk about it at all.
And it's still, in society, it still wasn't accepted, right?
Well, at that point, we were looking at mid-70s at that point.
Yeah.
You know, so it's post-Stonewall.
So I remember in my psychiatry training, so let's see, I graduated med school in 75. Yeah. Graduated med school in 75 because in my early psychiatry training, homosexuality was considered a pathology. I remember that. And I remember kind of buying that, just going along with that. And you remember the old psychoanalytic explanations were kind of, some of it was kind of crazy thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that people who were gay were crazy. I'm saying the thinking was kind of convoluted and didn't quite make sense. But I remember it was listed as a pathology and it's something that was diagnosable. That was in the mid-70s. So you're right.
Yeah. Because I don't know when the APA changed that position. John Fryer was a psychiatrist, I think, that spoke at the APA. And it did the very provocative kind of announcement. Mm-hmm. That interestingly, he was the psychiatrist in the department where my medical school was, which I found out 20 years after I graduated.
Yes.
So I think I worked. I think I sublimated. I think I just worked. I just worked and worked and that mm-hmm. kind of stuff and that. And then my best friend through high school and into college, I think in hindsight, he was gay. We never talked about it, ever. We didn't play with each other, nothing. I mean, he worked hard, went to college and that, and we would socialize and hang out and go camping kind of stuff. But it was all kind of like, and the reason I say I'm pretty sure is that he died at age 22 from a glioblastoma, which is a very malignant brain mm-hmm. tumor.
Yeah.
And that. And so I never got to actually ask him
yeah.
in that. But that's my hunch in that. So that may have been comforting to kind of know that here's somebody probably like me, I think. Right. We haven't talked about it. But in a way, that friendship probably helped me in a way get through that phase of my life.
Right.
Accepting myself partially, at least, in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a good friend and he was a good person. He worked hard. And again, he was raised, you know, bilateral Catholic,
right.
the whole scene with that too. But So yeah, went through college and that. And then I think after his death, it was pretty sad. I mean, when you're 22, you don't expect your friends to be dying. And he did. And that in college, met someone. And I think at that point, I was lonely. I think I was terrified of the secret inside and got into a relationship with that woman. And eventually we married. And I think it was not a good relationship. I think unconsciously, when a woman marries a gay man, I don't know, unconsciously, they must be picking up on something's not gelling. That's my own opinion on that. So it was not a great marriage in that. But I felt by doing that, I'd done what I was supposed to do. I kept on the Catholic heterosexual train. Train track, you know, in that. And then got into the marriage and it wasn't working in that. And I think what was haunting me were the thoughts, the secret kept creeping out, you know, in that. And again, what did I do? I worked. I worked for AT&T, which at that time was the largest corporation in the world. And you know, in like 2.5 years time, I went from like an entry thing and got 4 promotions and that kind of stuff and that, and it was nice and that. But I kind of work again. I think again, when stressed, when there's lots of conflict, just work kind of stuff like that.
And nobody was catching on that you were gay.
I don't think so. I kept it well guarded, you know. And I think my wife kind of was okay with the status quo. You know, it was not a real passionate marriage, but she had a job that she adored. I mean, she worked for a company that was opening retail stores all around the United States. So she would go for 4 months to Los Angeles, you know. And so it was two ships passing in the night, you know, every 4 months kind of stuff like that. So it kind of suited that in that. But I think also probably went into a major depressive episode around that time.
You did, or your wife did?
I did. Yeah. In hindsight, I had previous ones, but went into one then, and it was kind of like, who was I? I'm ashamed of who I am. You know, I'm working a lot. There's no joy in my life. You know, what's my future? All that. And I did some soul searching, and I actually, my background from college was in business and finance. And I had a great job at AT&T, and that back when they had more money than the Vatican. But I just felt very unhappy in that. So I went through a whole self-analysis kind of stuff, and I actually did a vocational exploration with a grad student at Columbia, because I was living in the New York area, and over several months. And it was just like, well, why'd you pick this career? It was like, well, my parents kind of picked it for me, kind of stuff like that. Well, we did all these things about, you know, occupational daydreams and looking at strengths and weaknesses and areas of interest in that. And what emerged was I had an interest in medicine, which I kept rejecting, saying, I can't do that. There's no way I could do that, you know, and kind of devalued myself. But worked with her, and she just said, well, why not? So what I did, and again, keep in mind all this conflict about who I am and the shame and the guilt, what do? I work.
Right.
So I needed all the pre-med courses. And in,
oh my goodness.
And in 3.5 years, I worked full time, was getting promotions, and took a year of bio with lab, chemistry with lab, organic with lab, calculus, physics with lab, anatomy and physiology. And I knew I had to do well. So got straight A's and everything. When you have a lot of personal conflict, you work.
By the way, where did you take the pre-med courses?
I took it at Rutgers in Newark. So basically, I had no free time. I mean, it was just and that. And then I went to apply to medical school. I figured I had to tell AT&T, you know, and that. And so they were actually wonderful about it. They thought it was so cool. And actually, one of my letters and my application to medical schools was written by a senior vice president of AT&T. which basically was nice. You kind of said that I was not running away from a failed career, basically.
Right.
So when I got into medical school and that. And so again, you know, as you know that medical school, what do? You work. You know what I mean? That. So I joke that I have no idea what TV shows were on in the 1980s because I was just constantly working or studying or taking tests or doing something in that.
So one of our one of the people on Zoom had Googled it and said, according to Google, the homosexuality was taken out as a pathology in 1973. So I was in med school then, so I might have gotten my med school and residency confused. However, if I'm understanding you correctly and my memory, even if it wasn't officially a pathology, it still wasn't something that was accepted.
Right? No. And to go back a bit, that there's a relative, he's like a third cousin once removed or something. And he is probably 15 years older than me. He was gay, and you knew he was gay. And several of my first and second cousins would laugh and make fun and mock him behind his back. Yeah. So that was like through middle school into high school. You know, they would mention his name and people would laugh, roll their eyes and that. Yeah. He, as soon as he got to, he left the city. He moved to a large city and got his PhD and comes back maybe for occasional wedding and funeral.
Right.
Kind of stuff in there. But so I grew up with that, the Catholic rejection, but then family members looking at somebody and then mocking and really, yeah, really, really nasty things behind his back.
So you got into med school. And see, just to summarize, it sounds like, well, I want to go back a second. Did you feel like you couldn't go into medicine because you were not worthy because you were gay? Or...
I think I just had self-doubts about was I smart enough to be able to do it. And
okay.
That, you know, and then also kind of did I have the resources? You know, because it would have meant, you know, initially when looking at it, you know, the recommendation was to quit my job and do the pre-med stuff very quickly. Well, financially, I couldn't do that at all. And so then looking at that daunting thing of like working full time and then doing this stuff, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it was probably more an idea that I didn't think I was maybe smart enough to do it.
But working so hard helped you cope with the fact that you were uncomfortable about who you were.
Yeah. Okay. And also probably protected me from AIDS.
Because you were so busy.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Because it was, that was 81, 80, all the way through the 80s. Especially those first several years, dangerous time, very dangerous time.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and that. You know, and then medical school and then residency. Mm-hmm. And then I went into medical school thinking about peds, but actually as part of my pediatric rotation, I worked with a child psychiatrist who trained at Rochester.
Okay.
And decided to do psychiatry. And as between internship and residency, the marriage officially came apart.
Right.
And we went our separate ways, which is probably best for both of us.
And again, I met you soon after that.
Yeah.
We became friends soon after that.
Yeah. And, you know, but then the marriage was over. And so at that point, it was probably went to another major depressive episode into there and that. And I went into therapy and you guys, there was a psychiatrist in town that saw a lot of people in training.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that if you were a resident or a PhD candidate in psychology, he did therapy for a lot of those people. Because sometimes you'd go in the waiting room and you'd see somebody else walk out and you kind of wave and stuff like that. And I had just kind of heard through the grapevine that he would probably be understanding. Because, you know, part of it was like, you know, I felt like I had to get a therapist that at least was okay with it. Stuff like that. And so, and I probably around the second year of my adult residency started that. And I started twice a week and stayed, and then eventually like 2-3 years later, then went to once a week. And that whole process was just, who the hell am I? Yes, this is who I am. What does it mean? it was really kind of like, who am I? This is who I am. And that's okay. I mean, summarizing 5 years of therapy, but that's kind of, you know.
Did Rochester seem like a gay-friendly town back then?
I don't know, because I was not a a gay bar person.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm not a bar person anyways.
Mm-hmm.
I know, I just find bars so noisy. I can't hear anything. I can't talk to people, you know, so that was not my scene. So I don't know, you know what I mean? And there was really no internet stuff really back then either. You know what I mean? And that.
So, were you catching anti-gay comments in your training?
I don't remember it. You know, I think as you and I had talked before, I mean, there was probably one supervisor who I wondered if there was some homophobia. Overall, I think with internship and residency and stuff, as long as you're doing the work, you know what I mean? It's like, you know what I mean? That's probably more of an issue than orientation. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. You want somebody who kind of knows what they're doing and shows up, right. Kind of stuff like that. So, and again, I worked hard and that. Right. So, yeah. But that whole time frame there was kind of who am I, understanding, yeah. Kind of stuff like that.
Well, did you start coming out more openly?
Yeah, I would say probably the first year of fellowship.
The chat fellowship.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm kind of remembering,
yeah.
That,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah. You know, as general residents, we each had to do a big presentation at Grand Rounds, and I delayed mine to the last possible month of my adult residency. And interestingly, I did mine on truth and morality. And that. And so in hindsight, I'm thinking, of course I did it on that. You know what I mean? Right. And that, you know, and how kids develop a sense of morality and how it changes as you get older and that kind of stuff. So I don't think it was a pure coincidence I picked that topic as my Grand Rounds topic, for sure.
Right. So in that time when you were coming out, did you feel you were discriminated against, or were you pretty well accepted? Or
I'm not aware of any of that. Yeah, I mean, no, I think it went fairly well. I mean, I think colleagues, people in the residency and fellowship, mm-hmm. You know, I think for all of them was like, it was like no big deal. You know what I mean?
Right.
I didn't feel any prejudice or rejection, at least at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then the big thing was my family,
right.
which I dreaded. I absolutely dreaded mm-hmm. it. I have an older sister and a younger brother. And I literally told her I was gay, driving the airport, just about pulling into the driveway of the house. I mean, and her response was, oh, that's cool. I mean, that she told me something years later, and it's similar to what a very good friend told me years later. And the theme was, both she and my friend were very, very sad for me the day I got married. And my friend who was in the wedding told me years later, he wanted to scream out, don't do this. It's not who you are.
Wow.
Yeah. And my sister never liked my ex-wife. And there may be various reasons for that, but I always wonder if it had something to do with that. Yeah. So she was cool with it.
Okay.
And my brother was cool with it. And that I never really told my parents.
Mm.
You know, I'm the middle child, so I do everything. I host Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, it's the middle child to me. And we're doing Christmas dinner and everything else. So it's obvious that my wife is gone. I'm divorced. It's obvious that this person's here. We're together. Give a tour of the house. We're sleeping in the same bed. So it was implied, but never said. Right. And they never asked.
Yeah.
it's
a version of don't tell.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that. On the other side of it was, because how could you not like him?
Uh-huh.
How could you not? I mean, look, it's like, how could you not like him? You know what I mean? Like that. So it was kind of like And he and my father would have all these great discussions in that, but just it never formally was said.
Right.
And then I think my mother, who was a worrier, was comforted that A, I was not alone,
mm-hmm.
that this person seemed to care for me. Probably that he was a doctor. She probably felt comforted by that.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that, and he was a nice guy. So I think they were comforted by that. But again, I never said anything and they never asked.
Right. That.
When my mother passed away, however, we were all sitting around the funeral home and my siblings were there and my father, and we were writing the obituary for the newspaper. And it was my sister and her husband's name and my brother and his wife's name. And then, what does John do?
Mm-hmm.
And my father didn't want that. At which point, my brother said, it goes in the same for all three, or none of it goes in. At which my sister seconded. So it went in. He said nothing, which was his pattern.
Right.
So it went in that way. Yeah.
So that must have felt comforting to you.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I was comforted that my brother said it.
Yeah.
But the fact I felt my emotion with it was, again, rejection.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a mix. When I think back to it, it's a mixed feeling for sure.
And yeah.
Yeah.
So you were out, and it's kind of obvious if people knew you and hung out with you. It wasn't, I don't remember it being a prominent thing when we were working together. Right.
Well, see, that's a good point, because sexuality is part of who you are,
mm-hmm.
but it's not the only part. You know what I mean? And I think some people, you know, they'll say I'm gay, and that's everything they are. It's a huge, to me, it's part of who I am. But there's so much more to me. You know, and you know, Henry, you know, all my interests and things I like to do and everything else. And that, you know, if I look at all the things that make up who I am, it's many things, you know, I think.
But, you know, that's a really interesting point, because when I think about our friendship, I think of you now as one of my gay friends. You're not the only one. But I didn't start thinking of you that way until being gay seemed, I'm not sure this is accurate, seemed to be more important to you. I'm not saying it correctly. It's like I knew you as John, and you're friendly and you're bright, and we won't comment about your record keeping and da 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 and all your many interests. But you were right. You wanted to write. Remember all of that. And that's how I knew you.
Right. I mean, you think about the writing. Starting a nonprofit, we worked together on that. You
right.
know, doing presentations for Montessori in Europe. You know, I would show you the PowerPoints and that, and get your feedback on that.
At some point, something switched in me, in that it seemed like it was more important to you to be even more open about that part of you, that you were gay. And I'm remembering it being around the time that you broke up, which was really hard.
I think in hindsight, it was a function of many things,
mm-hmm.
and they were accepting. But I think we came into that. It was, for both of us, our first true, serious, serious relationship.
Right.
That publicly, to our families and to our friends, we were a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think, developmentally, that was key. But there were issues where we couldn't stay together,
right.
unfortunately, in that. So I think part of it was the relationship probably helped us move forward with our own self-acceptance.
Yeah.
At some level. But we eventually went our separate ways.
And if I remember right, when you did have that separation, which, again, as an outsider, but your friend remembered, you were really grieving, and boy, did you work.
Yeah. I mean,
like you went back.
Yeah.
You were, whatever you were doing to that house. And
No, I love to write. I mean, I Henry helped me start a nonprofit, and that kept me very busy, travel and doing presentations and that. And I wrote 3 or 4 screenplays and stuff. And that's like, when in doubt, when anxious, when conflict, work, you know. And then eventually met someone else, John. And John is also a physician and that, Catholic on both sides, priest in the family, the whole road show. And we hit it off. We got together. At that point, we are out to our families, mm-hmm. very much so in that. So I think our families at that point were just like, oh, thank God the two of them found each other.
Right.
Their arc for their acceptance had clearly moved along as well. So the friend that helped, who I'd known for years, had a very, very strong, fundamental Christian kind of way of looking at things, was accepting of the relationship. When I announced that John and I were going to get married, it essentially led to an end of the relationship permanently.
Right.
Which was, it's a loss. It's a sad loss, for sure.
It really caught you by surprise, too.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Did that cause other ripples in other relationships?
No, only that one.
Only that?
We were married in a fallen away Catholic church. I'll call it. It's a very progressive church that follows a lot of the Catholic traditions, but very welcoming to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point, usually, does anybody here have any just reason why these two shouldn't get together? Well, being this church, they kind of do the positive. Aren't you all happy these two are together? You know, and people cheer. And I think that's where I think both our families are going like, oh, thank God they found each other, kind of stuff like that.
So again, just to me, it was a great wedding and reception. And, and it was the most open I had ever, the most open I had ever seen you, not just in terms of about being gay, but just being you. I mean, you guys are such a great couple and you're so in love. And there was like the feeling I had is that no way was this going to be hidden under the rug anymore in any way. And so you had a big bash. I mean,
180 people. Yeah. And we planned every bit of it ourselves. It was on our cottage property. And it was a blast. You know?
Yes.
But people have said it was one of the most joyous weddings they've been to. Yes. And I think it was because it was just everybody there wanted to be there. Everybody there, I believe, was accepting. Except for one or two people, I think, that were uncomfortable, but in that. And people were really, truly joining in the joy and of the whole event in that. But I think...
What made you and John decide to get married?
I guess the definition to the relationship that it gives, you know what I mean? I think that, mm-hmm. the wanting to be together. I think there's also kind of a legal thing. With it as well, you know, a practical thing in that. But I think to kind of celebrate the union, you know, John comes from a huge family. He's one of 7 boys in that. And so it's a huge family. And a lot of his nieces and nephews at that point were kind of in their early to mid 20s. And I think they've seen their uncle through other relationships that were not particularly good, didn't last in that. And mm-hmm. so they were all cheering. I mean, I think the family was just so happy for us all.
Right.
And I think, Henry, what you're probably picking up is that we were happy. I mean, I look at the pictures of that day, and you can just see it kind of jump off the picture prints,
you know,
which was probably, if you look at my arc from that terrified middle schooler, knowing I'm saying something wrong to the PhD candidate, you know what I mean? Right. Or terrified I might get aroused in the locker room in high school and get beat up, mm-hmm. you know, that my arc has gone a long way over the years than that.
So your husband, John, if I understand, it sounds like he probably had more discrimination against him professionally than you experienced.
He might have, I think. I think also initially some of the family response may have been difficult.
Yeah.
Again, kind of the bilateral Catholic, you know, priest right. in the wings kind of stuff. I mean, it's, right. it's loaded. You know, I met his father, obviously, later in life. And I have to say that my father-in-law, which is nice to be able to actually to say that my father-in-law, mm-hmm. my father-in-law is so very accepting and happy for us in that. I mean, I would say every time we see him, if not every time, just about every time, you know, as we're leaving his place, he'll say, "I'm so happy you two found each other." In that, you know, the nieces and nephews, that, if they're in town, they love to stay here. In that, and everyone's the families are so very accepting on both sides. You know, for the wedding, I was a little bit concerned about my first cousins again because they're all the ultra-Catholic ones in that. And we had sent out save the date cards and we sent them to everybody, you know, except I did not send them. There was 5 envelopes from my first cousins and I hung on to those because I was kind of, I didn't want to say too much to them. I think like, oh, fuck, will they even come? You know what I mean? Kind of stuff. Like, it's going to be another rejection. You know, and some of those cousins were ones I grew up with. They were like siblings because we did everything together. And I finally just said, like, oh, screw it. I'm going to do it. And they all came. They all came and that and joined in the celebration and that, which was nice. That was validating.
So what do you think about the state of things now? In your life, it sounds pretty good. In your circle of friends, I'm assuming you're comfortable professionally where you're working in New York State. But in general...
Well, I think professionally, I'm not a huge self-discloser with my, yeah. I've never been, I've been conservative with that, when I had it off, I don't put a lot of family photos. I just never really done that. Right. Part of it is, I think part of it, my training is more, don't do a lot of self-disclosure. You know what I mean? In that, keep it cleaner with that. Yeah. Maybe in the beginning, it was a function of residual shame, guilt, etc. But I would say at least the last 20 years, it's more a function of, I just don't do a lot of self-disclosure about my personal, mm-hmm. my personal life and all that kind of stuff and that. I just think it muddies the water kind of mm-hmm. stuff like that. You know, I probably 20, 15 years ago, I may have been a little more worried that would a family or an agency or something not want me because of that, because of their belief system. And because I just knew a lot of self-disclosure that was never tested. Right. I think I'm at the point now, probably in the last 10 years at least, it's just like, I am who I am. I think I do reasonably good work and, you know, maybe a little bit better than some others. And so if you want me clinically, take me for who I am. If not, well, then go somewhere else.
Right.
Kind of stuff like that.
So you travel a lot alone and with your husband. Anything you pick up in your travels or anything you have to be, you feel like you're being extra careful about?
Well, I mean, when we travel, sometimes we go with family, sometimes we don't. We don't go to a lot of gay venues. You know what I mean? And that, like our honeymoon, we went to Denmark and the Faroe Islands and that. And we're tourists. You know what I mean? That kind of stuff and that. I think in the way things are shifting, sometimes I'm probably more concerned about it than John, but I worry about traveling to certain areas of the country. And then it's kind of frightening some of the shootings and some of the bars and stuff. That's pretty scary kind of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's more a function of the reality of the risk in certain situations versus my lack of acceptance of who I am. You know what I mean? I think it's more the reality of like, there's crazy people out there. you know, kind of stuff like right. that.
Are there places you stay away from on purpose?
Well, with COVID, we haven't really traveled much, you know what I mean, in that. But yeah. we're looking at, and part of it, several of the last trips we've done in the last 2 years have been nieces and nephew weddings, that kind of stuff and that. Vacation this summer, we're going to go to Europe.
Mm-hmm. And that. So yeah, you're not attracted to countries that are known for their homophobia, so you're not going to the Middle East.
No.
Places like you go to Europe and yeah. Scandinavia yeah. and you feel pretty comfortable there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the major, you know, London, Paris, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, you know, mm-hmm. Germany. I mean, it's, I think it's pretty open right. to that. Yeah.
So I want to remind people, if you have any comments or questions, you can write it in the chat or you can try unmuting and speaking up if you want to say something. So it sounds like in your journey, the biggest challenge was you accepting yourself.
Yeah.
Feeling okay. And you did grow up at a time when it wasn't okay to be gay.
Mm-hmm. But, well, I think in society, in my family, and in my religion.
Right. And, well, I guess in your profession, even though it wasn't officially a diagnosis anymore after 73, I still remember it as being not something that was well accepted that it was okay. I think it's well accepted now, except maybe for a group who just won't accept it. But generally speaking, I don't think I'm not feeling any question in psychiatry about that now, but I think there was early on. You know, it takes a while for it to get through. But that, you know, that self-acceptance and being comfortable. So there's one question that came in, wondering if you have ever externalized homophobia by pathologizing patients early on in your practice, or how you dealt with colleague pressures to do so in some way, and how did you feel afterwards?
That to me? Or
a good question. Is it to John or here to both of us? Why don't you go first, and you're the guest.
I remember in medical school in Philadelphia, on a fourth-year rotation in internal medicine, we were rounding, and there was an AIDS patient who was quite ill, and the attending was atrocious. He was rude to the patient, and when we walked out of the room, he spewed all this horrific homophobic stuff about the patient and AIDS and lifestyle choices and stuff. It was, I never forget that.
Yeah. So I don't remember doing it. Two things I remember. One is I was just going along, not thinking. If psychiatry said it was a pathology, then it was a pathology. And if they said it wasn't, then it wasn't. Which is kind of, I wish I had been more of a thinker and a challenge.
But I think, wasn't that 73 decision was very controversial?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's squeaked by, you know what I mean? I mean, yeah, it wasn't wholeheartedly, you know, a huge majority.
Right. And I think I didn't question it, but I didn't question it when it was a pathology that much either, except some of the psychoanalytic interpretations were like, really? But there was a lot of that going around, not just about being gay. So I don't remember ever consciously reacting to someone because they were gay and pathologizing them more because they were gay or pathologizing the gayness. I remember wondering, oh, I wonder what made them change their mind, like a committee decision. And I bought that the research said, look at this is normal. It's not a pathology. I do remember I only had one experience with a transgender person. And it was really clear cut. It was not as accepted as it is now, even though now we're getting a lot of backlash. And it was clearly seen as a pathology, but the person I mean, fit all the criteria. And one of the biggest names in psychiatry in Rochester had diagnosed it before I ever met this person. And I just inherited them and was helping them cope with going through the transition and what it meant socially. And I never felt discriminatory toward them that I'm aware of. My supervisor, I couldn't talk to my supervisor anymore about that person because it was really clear they just couldn't tolerate, which was really striking to me. Mm. So I don't know if that answers your question. I don't remember doing it. What I'm concerned about with me is I wonder what I've done unconsciously. You know, kind of like I'm a product of my culture. And to my knowledge, I didn't have a lot of gay friends. I didn't have, yeah, to my knowledge, gay friends growing up. One person in my high school, in retrospect, was probably gay. And I noticed, I remember we were taking driver's ed together. And there was something, and it was the way he said it. And at one point, we were walking somewhere, and he wanted to hold my hand. I remember that and feeling uncomfortable. I could have had lots of, you know, I went to an all-boys school, and it was a Catholic school, and I don't know, there must have been lots of gay guys there I wasn't aware of. So I don't know, did we answer your question?
Well, that one question about externalized homophobia by pathologizing patients. For me, I think over the years, the most difficult patients are the ones that are not stable psychiatrically. Mm-hmm. The ones that are floridly psychotic or there's a great potential for violence and aggression. Mm-hmm. Those are the patients that probably more on guard, frightened by whatever and that. Right. I'm not aware of homophobia pathologizing.
Right.
You know, also, like I said, I don't do a lot of self-disclosure. And so even if I'm working with a patient who tells me they're gay, you know, I acknowledge that, but I don't say, well, I am too. I mean, but it's not because of homophobia. I do that because I do that with everybody. I'm not a big self-discloser in terms of my professional work and that.
So being heterosexual, it's helped me that my gay friends have become more and more open about being gay. That part I'm aware of. I'm trying to think how I can explain how it helped me. I mean, I consider you a close friend, and I have another gay friend who I consider a close friend. And he probably talks about it more openly than you do. And I really love you two. You know, you're really close friends. And it's not made a difference, but it is, I hate to say it's taught me because it sounds so didactic. You've let me into something about life that I hadn't been a part of my life growing up. And that has been really helpful to me. And I hope it's allowed me to be more open about not just gay, but transgender, the way I relate to women, the way I think about all sorts of sexual experiences. So my other friend is an expert in treating different kinds of sexual issues. And he really is. I've really grown to trust him. And I told him recently things that I even now would kind of say, oh, no. You talk to him and it's like, what do you mean, oh, no? And I don't have a good reason. And he's taught me about the range of human sexuality, the range of human expression. And unlike when I was a young doctor, like I said, I just went along with, well, if it's a diagnosis, it's a diagnosis. You guys have really made me think. You know, it's what it is. And I, you know, like going to your wedding, and the other person, I was performing weddings at the time, and I married him. And I thoroughly, I mean, it was great. I mean, it was such an expression of love, both weddings, your wedding, which I came to honor that. The other wedding, I performed the service, you know, and it's love is love. It's, you express love, and that's the important thing to me. I've learned that as a heterosexual person who grew up overprotected and conservative and Catholic like you were. No. And I have seen other people who I had considered my friends discriminate and be uncomfortable around my gay friends. And that has bothered me. And with one person I'm thinking in particular, I was able to say, no, you don't do that. What are you thinking? And didn't get anywhere, except made me feel better that I could at least say, no, you don't do that.
I mean, I think for my arc, it was all this stuff about what I was supposed to do, supposed to do that. And I think over all these years, the 5 years of therapy really helped me understand and accept myself and allow me to kind of love who I am and that. And I think going back to what you said, kind of like, is that I'm gay, I'm married and that, but when we all hang out and that, it's like, we're just hanging out, you know what I mean? And that, and I just tell people that I think gay or straight, it's all the same stuff. It's all the same issues about intimacy and trust and communication, religion, money, maybe, you know, sex, all that. It's all the same stuff. The only thing that's different is that the plumbing's a little different. But other than that, it's all the same stuff, you know. And I think, you know, and so, you know, if I look at my arc, I've come a long way. And it's just, again, and again, like I said before, it's part of who I am, but it's only, it's not all of me. It's a part of who I am, but there's so many other parts to who I am.
Right.
You know, personally, professionally, and a member of a family, now a member of a very large family, and then, you know, interests, activities. It's just woven into the fabric of who I am.
What do you think of all the political and social backlash that's coming up now the past few years?
At least? I worry because I put myself back to that middle schooler. I put myself back to the kid in college, you know, that whole stuff and that. I had the wherewithal. I worked. So I, but not everybody can kind of do that. I worry that some people will internalize that more with self-hatred, and self-hatred may lead to self-medicating with substances, or self-hatred may lead to depression and or suicide.
And right. I do.
Yeah.
Somebody raised their hand, Scott.
Hello, John. I've enjoyed your sharing with us. A comment came to me on a post I'd made on a social media site. The post was originally, topless beaches are now legal on Nantucket. And the comment came in from someone from Germany. And they said, in Germany, we say everything is allowed that is not expressly forbidden. And something crossed my mind, and it kind of goes back to our political origins, and that's the idea of a constitutional democracy, right? And the differences of opinion on strict constitutionalism and the idea of experimental democracy. And I just wondered, if is there some point that you feel that your identity is has a legalistic kind of framework, or the point where it's been set in law within your own psyche, for example, that you can relate to, and what was it originally, and along the lines of, well, we're kind of born with this constitution, right? What behaviors are allowed that allows the experimental evolution of your self-identity? Is that too deep?
I think for me, I mean, I think it was always there. I think there's always been shrubs and bushes kind of hiding stuff. Some of it put in by society, some by religion, some by family. But when I look at it, I see big areas. I think middle school into high school, the realization of what the thoughts and fantasies meant was kind of phase one. I think the whole process in the 80s of that I tried to do what I was supposed to do, and that was not working. I think the working on the 5 years in therapy of clearing away the shrubs and bushes and saying, this is who I am, this has always been there, and that's okay, which then came, that's probably where I was at that point, that milestone. I think the relationship helped because I could tell the world around me. But I think at that point, I was probably still, it's always been there, and that's okay. Okay. But then I think in the last 15 years, probably culminating with the wedding. The wedding went from, it's always been there, let's clear away some more shrubbery and stuff so we can see who I am. But it went from okay to, let's celebrate who I am. So it's been that evolution over all that time.
I can really feel that.
And I think one of the things, again, I think about the wedding was that everybody was celebrating with us. I think, Henry, like you said, I think they were picking up on the relationship between John and I and how we were that day and what they knew about us in that. It's a process. It's a long process.
To tell you the truth, it helped. I didn't know you were involved with that church. And that church, look, I don't go to Catholic, I don't follow Catholicism anymore. But if I were going to, that's the one that I would go to. One, because they got excommunicated because they decided that women can be priests. And they decided they can marry gay people. And it's like, it's a no-brainer to me.
Well, divorced people can take communion. Everybody can take
communion. I can take communion when I go there. And part of it is the accepting nature. And when the questioner talked about legalistic, it made me think psychiatry now, always, but I think even more so now, is accused of over-pathologizing. And there is a point to that. So I don't know about, this is a little tangential to our topic about being gay, but I think it's related. Early on in my training, there was always a question raised about the person and the environment. So what influence did the environment have, you know, the nature-nurture thing, but also what's the environment in which this person is existing? And I do believe that we can have a social environment that's crazy and that's inducing suffering in the person. So, you know, it used to be more clear. You don't diagnose somebody unless there's objective and or subjective suffering. The person isn't getting in objective difficulty. They're working and relating and doing okay, and they're not feeling bad. You don't say they have a problem because they don't. And I think we've gotten away from that. And even more than that, I don't think there's enough appreciation that you have pieces of our society that are really malfunctioning. And so it's almost like saying, if you're not suffering, something's wrong with you because it's so crazy making. And I don't think we pay enough attention to that. So like I was saying, you and my other gay friend in particular, you're so open. I feel like you're making me look at what are the assumptions the society makes that just don't make sense. When you think about it, now that I can think, as opposed to when I was younger, it just doesn't make sense, right? And you're either creating suffering and then accusing the person of having something wrong when it's not it's not, that's not the way it is. It's the society and their assumptions that are incorrect. Not that that's an easy distinction to make, but I'm old enough. I don't know if you had this in your psychiatry training. I remember somewhere, must have been in med school, in psychiatry, talking about how dangerous psychiatry was in Russia, because they would use excuses to put people in psychiatric institutions because they weren't following the political philosophy, right? And I don't know if you had that in your training, but that was being used as an example. At least we don't do that in America. Well, yes, we do.
In other ways.
Yeah, in other ways. And if it's not political, it's societal. And I think the struggle we've had at recognizing that gayness and transgender and all sorts of other kinds of sexual expression are okay. The society not accepting it is what's not okay. And I don't think we're there yet, but I think we're getting there. So I know we're going to have to stop soon. I want to see if there was one more question. Othering has become a national pastime. Yeah, thank you. It really has. And I think professionally we have a responsibility to stand up when we see that happening. I'm not sure we're doing, well, I guess, you know, we're accepting transgender, and my friend who's more of an expert in sexuality, there's much more acceptance. If you're trans, I don't think it's made it into the societal or national or even in psychiatry. I think we're still pathologizing things up. I'm not sure.
But we talk often that we're glad we live in New York.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We're glad that we live in the city. The city is pretty accepting of that. I mean, I think we may have been one of the first in the country to have a gay city councilman like 30-something years ago, and that. So that helps, that at least in our church and our city and our county and our state are pretty accepting, especially compared to other areas.
Right. Well, the church you go to.
Not every
church in Rochester.
Right.
But you can find them, and it's okay. Well, I want to thank everyone, and I really want to thank you, John, because I know this was very personal. And I think it's a real tribute to you, and you're helping all of us.
I want to thank you, though, because I didn't realize till today kind of those milestones, because in hindsight, I would have thought the 5 years of therapy was when I got to the point of acceptance, blah, blah, blah. No, I got to the point of it's okay,
right.
You know, okay. And that, but it really wasn't, I think, until the wedding, which was an outward manifestation of, this is cool, we are celebrating, this is who I am, and that. So it kind of, you kind of helped me kind of realize that. I don't think I put that together.
I never quite told you this, but coming to your wedding was 95% honoring you and John. And it was 5% saying, good for Rochester, or good for... So the church you went, when they got excommunicated, we went to their first ordination of a woman priest, which is, they may have been already kicked out by then.
I think they probably were by then, yeah.
Yeah, but it was a big deal. And so Kathleen and I went, and there were people taking photographs, nasty people, not celebrating. And they were going to report to the whoever the mucky were in the traditional Catholic religion and show pictures and all of this. So we thought that was kind of funny. So it was overflowing and it was a big celebration. So I don't go to that church. I'm not practicing Catholicism, even that type, right? And we managed to get in a line to say congratulations. And she didn't know us, and we may have said, yeah, we don't go to this church or anything. And I remember her saying, why did you come? And all I could say was, how can I not come to something like this? You know? So it was like for her, in that situation, for me, it was, I want to honor you. But 80% of it is, I want to honor what's being done in Rochester, New York. And I don't care if I don't go to this church. We need something like this. With you and John, it was 95% you're my friends. But there was 5% that had the same feeling of, we absolutely, I want more of this, you know. So thank you for being my friend.
Thanks for being my friend and having me talk about this today.
Yes. And give my love to your husband. And bye to everyone. Bye-bye.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcast, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Give us a review on iTunes or post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. And be sure to check out Joel Lessie's podcast, Unraveling Religion, on your favorite podcast app. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amber Light International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.